This is Sarah Hesketh here with Miriam Johnson on June 29th, 2019. And we are here in Hudson taking part in the Oral History Summer School. And I met Miriam for the first time this week. And yeah, Miriam, can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Miriam Johnson.
Great, thank you. So I was wondering if you could start by telling me a little bit about your early years.
Early years. I'll go to my first memory. Well, not my first memory, but a time that when we landed in Tasmania. I was born in the US. And when I was six, for the second time, my family emigrated to Australia and we went to Tasmania. So that seemed, for my early years, that really kind of made a mark on me. It really formed me. I think even now I'm feeling the repercussions of it because my heart kind of broke. I felt I got shattered when we landed in Tasmania when I was 6 years old. And I thought, and I know it's kind of affected me up until now, and I guess one thing I'm wrestling with was like, how does something, you know, that happened so long ago have such a resounding effect throughout the rest of one's life? And the reason, trying to find the thread of this so that it kind of makes sense in storytelling. I guess I remember the day we landed in Tasmania, and it was in August, and that was winter, and it was cold and grey and wet, and we were picked up from the airport by this family that we were going to be staying at their house for a while to begin with. And I remember driving through downtown Hobart, through the center of the city. And we drove past what I now know to be is the GPO, the General Post Office, and it's this heavy sandstone building that was built in the 1860s or 1870s, and it was dark and foreboding, and that was the weather and the rain, as well as this big old sandstone building with a type of architecture I'd never seen before. And I feel that I was sitting, you know, at the window seat. And as we drove past, I just kind of felt my heart break because it just seemed so dark and cold and miserable. And that kind of stayed with me, and kind of I probably influenced the rest of my experience as a, you know, someone from young and from America growing up in, you know, landing first and then ultimately having to experience the hostile environment which Hobart, Tasmania, Australia was to me as a child.
And did you feel like you'd had any preparation for that move before you had left America?
You know, I don't think I did. Mind you, I was six. I probably was, you know, was told that we were going to be moving, and I was probably involved in the packing up of the house because we were living in Greenfield, Massachusetts at the time, and we'd only been there for a few years at that point. I probably was not thrilled with the idea, but I don't really remember. But one thing that I realize about myself, and I've known this for a long time, on many levels, I don't like change. And I don't know if I was born like that, or whether maybe the changes, the moving around in those early childhood years made me feel like that, or makes me feel like that more. I don't know what came first, but in some ways, even though I have some childhood memories from before arriving in Hobart when I was six, they're not consecutive. And I couldn't really put them together, and I don't know how much of them are my own real memories and how much are ones I've gained from the family history, the family lore, the family stories that, you know, my mother, my sister, and my father, we would talk about. So, yeah. Yeah.
Can you maybe describe a bit more of that family lore, or maybe what you mean by that term, lore?
Okay, when I say lore, I mean L-O-R-E.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm thinking of it in terms of the myths or the stories or the foundations, what holds a family together like a small unit, because my family, like there were four of us. There was my father, my mother, my sister, and myself. And we're the ones who moved to Tasmania. My parents were both first-generation Americans, and by that I mean that their respective parents had independently, all four of them had independently come to the United States in the early 20th century. My grandparents on my mother's side had come from Eastern Europe, and they had come through Ellis Island independently, and then they had met once they had got to New York. I think they were somewhere, they were both living, working somewhere on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. They met, I don't know if they fell in love, but they got married. And that was, you know, my mother's family. My father's family, both his parents were from Sweden, but they didn't know each other in Sweden. They both independently came to the U.S. I don't think they came through Ellis Island, but they both ended up in the Boston area, and that's where they met. So, you know, I come from a definitely, you know, immigrants, you know, yeah, so my parents, their parents were immigrants, and then my parents, you know, they were born in the U.S., but then they both, you know, they decided to move to Australia. So, again, when I say family lore, I'm referring to, I didn't really grow up with my extended family. I think most of my grandparents were, you know, half of them were dead before I was born, and then my last grandparent died, I think, when I was 8 years old, and I had, you know, known her for a month. I remember knowing her, you know, when I was maybe five. She came to stay with us for a few months, and that's my memories of her. So again, back to the family lore, it was just the small little nuclear family that ended up in Tasmania. So I don't know if it was because we were that kind of, you know, we had emigrated to Australia, we were isolated, and so the family law that I'm talking about, and I don't know if other families have the same thing, I assume they kind of do, but I guess the stories of my parents' childhood and the stories of, you know, their early life together once they got married, and the stories about my, you know, my sister and myself and our early years and where we lived and the dogs we had or the cats, and, you know, jokes and, you know, all sorts of things that became like a really strong part of our identity, I think, as a family. And that the sort of became, you know, part of the shorthand in the way we communicated with each other or when we were all together. And these were our touchstones because we were strangers in a strange land, I guess, and particularly moving to Tasmania in the 1970s was a pretty pioneering thing to do, because, to put it, well, I guess my perspective is it was a pretty backward place back then. It ain't that much different now. It is a lot different now in some ways, but back then it was not, you know, there weren't that many people from other places. There wasn't a lot of, the majority of the people who were Tasmanian were several generation Tasmanian who had, who were convict stock. They're, you know, going back five, six generations, their family, you know, Tasmania was a penal colony. And so a lot of the people who ended up, you know, the long-term Tasmanian families, they're either convicts or they were the masters or they were the merchants who came around the same time. So it was a very limited heritage and very English, Irish, Scottish heritage. And so, and Americans weren't, there weren't that many Americans I think in Tasmania at that time. And there was a real hostility that I experienced as a child to Americans, and I know it was there. It was palpable in other levels of society. I'm sure my parents experienced it in some ways, but you know, I remember as a child being called a septic tank by other children at the very expensive, you know, private school that I went to for a while, and that meant septic tank meant yank. And that was left over. Okay, this is the 70s, you know, but that was left over from, I guess, the Second World War era and probably the Korean War, because there are a lot of American servicemen who were in the Pacific and they spent time on the east coast of Australia particularly. And so I think the Australian male didn't really like American men, because guess who came in and swooped their girlfriends and wives off their feet. So there was this real anti-American sentiment, and also a real suspicion. Again, Tasmania was far more backward. That might not be the right word, but it's one that I can use, than, say, Sydney or Melbourne, the east coast of Australia. Because, you know, there was less sophistication, and there is a real hostility and a real, I've lost the train of thought, but there is a real apprehension about and dislike of foreigners and change and difference. It was a very insular place. It still is in many ways, but that has shifted over the years. But that was very brutally my experience as a child. And that's why our family lore, I think, was something that held us together, or maybe it was something that was spoken about a lot in those first few years when we were strangers in a strange land, because it gave us our own identity, and I guess we were all experiencing a very different life out and about. So when we were together as a family group, that became something that was very strong to us.
Given everything you just said, kind of the thing I'm really curious about is, why Tasmania?
Why did my family go to Tasmania? Yeah, it's in kind of interesting. Well, yeah, it is interesting. My father, during the Second World War era, he had, he put himself through college by working in the Merchant Marines, which was the Merchant Navy. Now, he, apparently the story is, again, this is the story. I don't remember my father ever actually telling me this. Or my, you know, did my mother tell me this? But this is what the lore, one of the stories of my family is. My father, I think, when he was about, like, he was from Boston. He loved the ocean. He was fascinated by the sea. And apparently near where he, you know, where the area that he grew up, it was close to docks and water. And so as a child, or as probably as a, you know, young teenager, he would go and walk around, and he was really loved ships and things like that. I guess around the time of the Second World War, my father tried to join the American Navy. They wouldn't take him because he was colorblind in this, and the test, he was colorblind in that, when it, back in those days, you had to read flags, semaphore, or something out, you know, just, you know, if a ship was 10 miles away, you had to be able to read the flags on the deck. And apparently my father was colorblind between red and green. And that meant he would not be able to read the flags at 10 miles away on another ship. And so the Navy turned him down. So he joined the Merchant Navy. And the Merchant Navy was the fighting navy, but it was the ones who, it was the ships that carried all the supplies, and it was the commercial shipping. And back in those days, they supported the navy, the fighting navy. So my father, that's how he put himself through college. He would go out to sea for, I don't know, I'm sure the journeys were at least 3 months. You know, there could be six weeks or 3 months or more at a time. You'd go out to sea, and then he would come back, and they would have money and do a semester of college. Because he came from, not poor, but, you know, working class background. His father was an electrician. There wasn't money in the family. They were first generation, you know, his parents were immigrants that arrived from, you know, from Europe. So my father was on his own, I think, putting himself through school. And so, yes, he would go out to sea, then he'd come back, he'd have enough money for, you know, to pay for, you know, tuition and his accommodation, he'd study, and then, you know, that semester is over, he'd go out to sea again. So that is, so So he was in the Merchant Navy, supporting the troops in the Pacific, and during that time he spent time in the Pacific, and I know he visited New Guinea and New Zealand and the east coast of Australia, definitely Melbourne and Sydney, and possibly even Brisbane. I'm not sure if Brisbane was a working port at that time, but the upshot of that was there was something about Australia he liked. I never asked him, or he never told me more specifically what it was, but the story that came to me, that would have been from my mother, was on the day that they met at this party in the Lower East Side of New York in 1952, apparently, that the day that they met, he said, "Oh, I'm emigrating to Australia." So he had already, so this is like the 19, you know, this is 1952 by this point. I think he would have finished his university education. I think he would have been, maybe a teacher by then. But he had it in his mind that he wanted to emigrate to Australia. So that's why we emigrated to Australia. But to just jump forward a little bit more, the reason why we went to Tasmania, by the time we went to Tasmania, he'd put aside teaching and he'd studied again and he'd become a chiropractor. And the reason we went to Tasmania, like, they decided they were emigrating to Australia, and again, this was the second time they were emigrating at that point, but it was the one that lasted. So I think they didn't know in Australia where they wanted to go. They didn't really mind. And a chiropractor in Tasmania advertised through whatever, I don't know, however that information got out back in those days, but advertised for a locum. He was a chiropractor based in Hobart. He wanted to go take his family to Europe or the States for 6 weeks, and he wanted the chiropractor to come and fill in. My parents answered that. The arrangement was made. We landed in Tasmania. This family are the ones who picked us up from the airport. And my understanding of the story, the family lore, is that, you know, on the drive back from the airport to this chiropractor and his family's house, this guy told my parents, "Oh, I've decided we're not going away for our 6 weeks, so we don't need a locum." And so the story goes that my parents were like, "Oh, okay, well, look, we like the look of this town, so we think we'll stay." And they went and put, as my mother put it, they put a shingle up on the other side of town. And that's how we got to Tasmania. How and why?
So could you maybe describe for me a little bit what those first few years of living in Tasmania were like for you?
I think they're really bewildering for me. Because I felt, I think I wouldn't have felt happy myself, because I really feel it's true that I was kind of devastated when we landed, and I just felt like I was in the wrong place from the moment we arrived there. So there was that. Then there was also, we arrived in August, and in Australia the school year goes like from, you know, January to December. In the States it goes from like September to June. So when we arrived, I would have gone into the beginning of grade one. As it was, I went into the last semester of grade one in Australia. So I had missed out on, you know, the first, you know, 6 months, two semesters or terms or whatever it was. So that was bewildering, to be thrown into a different school situation, but at a level that was far more advanced than what I had already, you know, been experiencing, because I'd probably been in the equivalent of kindergarten. And I do remember the house we ended up living in, an area, a suburb called Lena Valley. Fortunately, the house was walking distance to the primary school, the elementary school that I went to. And I remember coming home for lunch every day, and my mother taught me to read. Now, the thing is, the backstory is, she was also a teacher at that point. So she, you know, she could teach me to read, and she was, you know, she had a, there was a technique, I think it was it called glass analysis? There was a technique that she'd learned about, you know, teaching, you know, children to read, that she managed to fast track and get me reading. You know, so before the end of the one semester that I did at grade one, I was reading better than anybody else in my class. But, you know, I guess for me it would have, you know, it would have been a mad sense of bewilderment and sadness and just, you know, desperately trying to find a way to fit in and make sense of what was going, you know, what my surroundings and the life that I'd been, you know, thrust into, and also contending with the family dynamics of, you know, parents who are pioneers who'd taken us to a strange land, and they were excited about it, but also having to find their way and get set up. And, you know, I had a sister who was 4 years older, and I think we got a cat fairly quickly. So, yeah, it was a very busy, confusing time, you know, part of my childhood.
And what about your sister?
You know, I don't know about my sister. She was a strong presence. She was 4 years older than me, so I looked up to her in many ways because she was my big sister, and I guess within the family dynamics I was supposed to look up to her, and you know, that's just the way it was. I think I respected her quite a lot at that time. I don't know how close we were. I think that was probably a big enough difference in ages that we didn't play together as such, but she was a strong She was strong. I think, you know, at times I tried to emulate her and times I didn't like, but, you know, I felt very different from the sort of choices or things that she was doing. I think it was probably a complex dynamic between her and me and then our parents. I guess a little side story. Just in that sense that I had a sense that my sister wasn't always happy that I was her sister. I think when I was older, my sister articulated that to me in the sense that, you know, she didn't want a sister. 4 years, I guess, she had been the only child, and I think she on some levels definitely resented having a younger sister born in and taking away some of the attention that she was used to getting. So I guess I felt close, but only up to a certain point with her. And I also think, especially now as we're, you know, so much older, we are blood and we are sisters, and there are some things we have in common, but there's so much that we don't have in common. And I think that was probably, I can be far more articulate about it now, or as, you know, once we became adults. But I think that was really, would have been quite a, you know, that would have been something I couldn't articulate back then, but it was probably just as true. And there would have been a sense possibly of conflict or, not conflict, but, you know, within the family, the idea that it would have been a disparity between, like, the idea of the happy family and the closeness that can come with that, and also maybe the way I felt about my sister and the lack of, you know, some real warmth and closeness, you know, different to the, you know, the family portraits or the families that you read about, Anita Blyton, or those kind of books where everybody's all loving and they're, you know, me and my sister, we didn't quite have that level of closeness.
And so did you maintain, did you maintain a relationship with America whilst you were living in Tasmania?
I maintained a longing for my idea of America, and I think that really dictated a lot of my choices along the way up until I was actually able to get back to the United States as my own Yeah, as a, oh, I don't like the word, I'm trying to think of the right way to describe it. Yeah, when I came into my own and I was able to do it under my own steam, it was, how old was I? Wow. Was I 27-ish, I think, when I finally got to the United States, to do my own thing. So, I think I've been pining for it, I've been longing for it, I've been fantasizing about it, I've been jonesing for it. New York was a beacon to me. And that was also because growing up, my mother was from Brooklyn, and she grew up, her childhood experience, she grew up as a child of Eastern European Jews in the East Brownsville and East New York section of Brooklyn. And she was born in 1925, so her formative years were like, the 1930s up until 1940. And again, I grew up with the family lore of her stories of growing up in Brooklyn and New York at the time. And to me, it still seems like the most golden period, just because of just the vitality, everything that was going on, the culture and the art and the politics and the energy, hearing about it through her eyes and through her stories and her experiences, I guess I absorbed, I took in a lot of that, and so it doubly, that just encouraged my fixation and my fascination with it as a city, and also that sense of rupture that I'd always felt as a child when we landed in Tasmania. That kind of like, I just felt completely torn, and bereft, torn away from where I felt my sense of place was, even though I don't wouldn't have had those words back then. That's kind of how it was. And so, yes, it became this place, this mystical, mythical place to me, as I was growing up. But when I finally got there, it was all of that and more. So, it wasn't like, oh, it was this place that, and then when I got there, it let me down. It was like this place that, oh, when I finally got there as an adult, as someone who was, I know, what am I, got there on my own steam and I could do what I want. It was like, yes, this is the place. I've never felt disappointed in New York. I've been exhausted by it, I've been drained by it, but I've also at the same time been exhilarated by it and fulfilled by it and stimulated and excited, and there's just too many words. And as demanding as New York is on every level, it gives as much as it takes. So I guess I've always found it to live up to my fantasies, my expectations, my desires, my longings when I was a teenager or my early 20s. And most of America, in some ways, has maintained that. And I've spent time in like the Mythic West. I first went to kind of the first place I really ended up for a length of time when I first got to the States in 1993 was New Mexico. And I ended up there because of Georgia O'Keeffe, because I'd finished a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in Tasmania, and while I started off as a printmaker, ended up working in painting and photography, and while I was at the there, I had a good background in fine art before I even got to art school. There'd always been art books and things around, and I'd had been aware of it. But I guess I remember finding in the art school library over my time of doing my degree a variety of books, catalogs about, of work of artists who'd spent, well, inadvertently, well, it was, think people like Georgia O'Keeffe and Richard Diebenkorn and Helen Frankenthaler, they're like some of the names specifically, and even Mark Rothko. Georgia, okay, everybody knows she spent time in New Mexico, but I'd be looking through a book of Diebenkorn or Frankenthaler, and there'd be, five paintings particularly that I'd be drawn to, and I'd be poring over them and looking at these reproductions, and I'd be looking at the title, and it might be untitled 1957, but then they'd be like, oh yes, it was painted in New Mexico. And so what I found was, the, you know, I was drawn to the art that was created by artists when they were in New Mexico. And that got me thinking. And my photography professor, David Stevenson, he was actually from the United States, and he had done his double master's degree in photography at the University of New Mexico. And so he talked about that. And so that made me aware about the university and the photography program that they had. And also, around that time when I was at art school, I married an Englishman, a painter who was in Tasmania. He was doing his master's at the university, University of Tasmania Center for the Arts, and he'd come over to Tasmania to do his master's in painting, and he was a landscape painter, and he was drawn to Tasmania because of the landscape. And for our first wedding anniversary, he made a really big mistake and gave me a copy of, I'm going to get the name wrong, the writer's name wrong, Georgina Rosenblum, something. Anyway, it was a very definitive biography of Georgia O'Keeffe that had been recently published. And it was a really thick paperback, and he gave that to me for our first wedding anniversary. And it was exhilarating. It was one of the most mind-blowing books I've ever read, and I reread it again a couple of years ago, and it's just like, yes, it did. You know, it had such a big impact on my life back then when I read it, and again when I reread it. But what it did for me was it gave me the impetus, the energy, the strength to leave him. I didn't just leave him just because of the book, but there's a variety of circumstances and events, and when it came down to it, it was just like, by that stage we were living in England together, and I was just like, to hell with you, I'm out of here, I'm going to New Mexico. And that had been my plan before I met him, because of looking at the art and being feeling very drawn to New Mexico by what the sense of place that I got from looking at at O'Keeffe's work and the other painters, you know, that I'd mentioned before, and also talking to David Stevenson, because by that time I was really focusing on photography. So that had been my bent before I met this guy, and we fell in love and got married. And so I managed, you know, he managed to persuade me, or it just seemed like, oh, we'll go to England, because he needed to go back to England. And I was just like, well, okay. But when things kind of went sour very quickly once we got to England, I was just like, okay, that's it. I'm going back to doing what, you know, I'd originally planned to do, because that really was what I needed to do. So, I guess talking about, you know, my sense of America, yes, there was a lot of longing and thinking about it from afar, and then I got there.
Could you maybe talk about your relationship with landscape?
Definitely. I'm not sure when it started, but sense of place is something, an idea that I've been working around and thinking around since for such a long, long time. And some of it stems from growing up in Tasmania, which is a dense mountainous island at the end of the earth. And I always felt really crushed by it. On a physical level, the geography, I found it crushed me, because Hobart is a city. There's a mountain that's about 3,000 meters, I think, tall. So it's a fairly, that's Mount Wellington, that's a fairly serious mountain. It's snow-capped a lot of the time, sometimes even in summer. So there's a mount. The Hobart is a city that's at the base of the mountain, and also it's on a river, the Derwent River, which apparently Hobart is on the deepest natural harbor in the Southern Hemisphere, which is why it ended up being such a dynamic place for. That's why, you know, I guess the convict settlement, you know, happened there. You know, I think it was the second place after Sydney was settled as a convict settlement. Hobart was next, again, because of the natural harbour. It made it easy for the English to bring their ships in and whatever. So again, Hobart is very picturesque. It's quite beautiful. Tasmania, again, dense mountainous island. It's got heavy clouds. It's got amazing clouds, but the clouds often are very heavy. And so I know I felt trapped. And I don't know how much I understood it before I got to New Mexico, but once I got to Albuquerque, which is where UNM, University of New Mexico, was, and again, that was kind of a little bit of a fluke, but I ended up being on a road trip through the Southwest with some family friends. I'd been been jonesing for New Mexico and planning to go there, but I hadn't quite figured out how I was going to get there. I'd left England and the marriage was in Berkeley staying with these family friends, and they said, we're going to do a road trip through the Southwest just to, show you around. I ended up signing up for summer school in photography, and so I moved there ostensibly maybe for 6 or 8 weeks, and ended up staying for about a year, year and a half, I think. But when I got to New Mexico, that is when my mind was blown in some ways by the landscape. And I think maybe I really started to think about landscape in a different way, because there it was so open and there was such a sense of space and a horizon. It was the complete antithesis to Tasmania, which was like this heavy, dark, moody place. And then you had New Mexico. Albuquerque is a city at the intersection of two highways, Highway 40 going east-west and 25 going north-south. Now, 40 goes, I think, from, L.A. to New York. I mean, it pretty much goes across, I'm pretty sure, the breadth. I'm not sure. It might not go almost all the way to New York City, but it goes pretty close. So that goes east-west. And it's also, Albuquerque is also at the foot of the Sandias, which is, I'm not too sure how tall a mountain that is, but it's pretty tall. So you got a mountain and you got a highway, and that kind of balanced out the Hobart mountain and the river. And Albuquerque is the city that's around the foothills, but if you look to the west, well, back then in the 1992-93, there was this big open space about 10 miles to the west of like downtown Albuquerque, and that was called West Mesa. And that was in the area where there's three extinct volcano cores. And back then, there weren't houses out there. And the people that I met were into, in a very classic New Mexico, Albuquerque way, they're into walking their dogs and at dusk. And so a couple of people would get together, a couple of cars, and load a few their dogs into the back. And then they'd go up to West Mesa and go dog walking. And I fell in with them and I'd go out with them. And it was just blew my mind, because you're out there on the edge of the desert, and like the desert is so different to anything else I'd ever experienced before, because again, I grew up in Tasmania, which is like Australia, which is bush, which is this dense, scrub that you can't, it's kind of prickly, and it's difficult to walk to unless there's already a path there. And Tasmania, I think it's still, if not three quarters, half of it is still this wilderness that you can't even walk through. People don't, white man has not been through. So to get out to New Mexico and get out to West Mesa at sunset, and there's this sense of breath and space, and you can see the curve of the earth, and it's just, it lifts the lid off of everything. Your mind expands, your heart expands, your spirit expands. Well, that's how it seemed to me. That's how it affected me. And I think for the first time, I became really aware of how the physicality of space affected me and affected my physicality and the way I thought. And it made me really start to think about, location and landscape and geography as destiny. All these kind of things which I've been ruminating around ever since. So in many ways, getting to New Mexico was a very formative experience for me. And then jumping ahead a little bit, when I moved to New York City for the first time as an adult, that again was a whole nother physicality. Like, it's not a landscape, but it's definitely a different scape, and compared to the horizon of the West and the West Mesa. In outside of Albuquerque, you have this verticality of Manhattan, and to a very different dynamic because it's a city and you have all the skyscrapers and you have the subways and you have the narrowness of the streets and the sunshine and the lack of sunshine. To me, it was equal but different. And in that context, I guess for me, like the Holy Trinity became Tasmania, New Mexico, and New York. And there's a real dialogue between those three places and how they affect me. And I guess in many ways, I go back to all three and I feel tied to all three in varying degrees at different times. But I think there's something, it's the triumvirate, it's something that I will always be working around or thinking around in ways.
Geography is destiny.
Yeah, and I don't know if I made that up or I'm sure other people have said it. I don't know if I heard other people or read it before I kind of took it on as like one of my sayings, one of my mantras, one of my profound truths. But I feel, I know for me, where I am affects how I think, and environment affects how I think, and you can extrapolate that out or bring it down to the room that you're in, the street that you're in, the town, the city, or the general landscape. But I feel, my own experience tells me that, you know, I feel oppressed when I'm in Tasmania. I feel a lot of that is to do with the landscape and the geography and the structure of the way the whole city, the whole state, well, the parts of the place that I know and frequent, the way the roads are over the landscape, how one gets around. Same in New Mexico, and then same in New York. I mean, New Mexico, you're at the intersection of two highways, so there's a lot of highway driving when you're driving in and around Albuquerque. You're at the intersection of two highways. There's a lot of highway driving when you're driving around there, and that affects the way you, traverse the city. When, you know, it's a driving city. When you're in a neighborhood, maybe you walk around a bit, but you do tend to drive quite a bit because it's kind of spread out, because it's, yeah, a very sprawling kind of city. New York is different again. I have rarely driven there. I hate it, but I traverse it by walking and then the subway. And so the way, hold the structure of the way you get around within that city. I mean, it's dictated by the geography of the city. And if you start looking into the history of Manhattan and how it was founded and what is the 15th century? Is it 1500, 16th century? I'm a bit fuzzy on dates. I'm not good at that, but was it when the Dutch first got there? They were at the very beginning of Manhattan, and then they slowly worked their way up. And how the whole place was, Manhattan was settled, and how, you know, up around Central Park there were like big estates, and how the avenues were laid out, and then the streets, and how it's all higgledy-piggledy down in the early, 15th, 16th century, 17th century parts of town down. Down by the waterfront down there, I've forgotten what it's called, that area, even though I know it really well. So that kind of affects how you traverse the city and how you feel in the city and your sense of how you move in the city. And I find that, if I'm in Rome or Venice or anywhere you go, I find it fascinating how it is developed. And I think you find that it's dictated by the geography and the history and how society and community and the communities develop there. And yeah, that's how geography, that's one level of how geography is destiny. And I expect, if you start looking at industry within areas, again, that, what is around, what the geography allowed dictates a lot of the industry and where the money came from. The fur trapping that happened on the east coast of the US, or the ability to get the furs from the trappers who are, way further north in, upstate New York, and then further west you know, where it was cold. It was, you know, geography dictated that those furs could get to the Dutch merchants in Manhattan. You know, that's back in the 1700s. So, yeah, that's kind of what I'm, the sort of stuff I'm talking about is geography is destiny.
So you used the word dialogue when you were talking about New Mexico, New York, and Tasmania. Are you in Tasmania in dialogue now?
We are in, oh, I want to think of a really clever word to say what we're in. It's all up in the air in many ways. Dialogue. I guess so. I'm in a running dialogue in that, you know, I've got voices in my head talking to me about Tasmania the whole time. And that kind of, one thing that, yeah, I've had a difficult relationship with Tasmania and Australia all my life since, you know, I got there when I was six. And one thing that I used to think, I've thought about this many times, particularly over, say, the last 5 to 10 years when I'm wrestling with Tasmania, when I'm there and like how I feel about living there or being there or feeling stuck there. When I'm in Tasmania, I often have like a monologue going on in my head complaining about Tasmania, like all the things about it that I don't like, which is pretty much across every level of every aspect of being and living and having to, you know, deal with everything in that place. And what I find is when I'm not in Tasmania or Australia, that monologue goes away. So that's the monologue thing, which I find relates pretty mainly to my life when I am actually physically in Tasmania or Australia. Dialogue, yeah. As much as I might hate, might come across as hating it, think I hate it, will say I hate it, I do think I am the sum of these places. And Tasmania, whether I like it or not, whether I'm happy about being taken there or not, it has profoundly influenced and affected so many things about my life. And I guess I'm at the point now where I can probably consider it and reflect on it in a way that's less, debilitating is not the right word, but less negative. I guess I'm getting more reflective and less responsive. I might have to tease that out at some other point. I don't quite have the language for it. But I think I can distance myself a little bit from it now, and I can see how it affects me, or I can see it and not have it affect me quite so profoundly. This is something that's I think is a relatively recent thing, my ability to be able to maybe separate the emotional, my emotional response to the place, and I don't know if it's even a reality thing. Yeah, see, I'm struggling with the words to describe it, but I think I'm getting closer and better at separating my emotional response and being able to be more realistic and also see the benefits, because there's something about, the beauty of growing up on a place in an island at the end of the earth is that it gives me such a perspective on so many other things. And I think as an adult now, I am appreciating that sense of distance. And again, I don't know what came first. You know, I was forced into that distance. And so maybe it has just become a part of me, and I'm finally able to make it something that I can use rather than feel that I aggrieved about or feel that it's, you know, it's affected me adversely. But I think I really appreciate the distance, the ability it's given me to see things like, I guess I've always felt like an outsider there. And because of the circumstances of where I've lived and when, I kind of feel like an outsider most places. But that's kind of okay, because I actually find it a good position, it's an interesting place to be. I like that sense of distance. I like that sense of observation. And maybe, you know, that could be something that, you know, analyst might want to go through if I, you know, but I don't, you know, as an artist, as a creative, as a way of thinking, I think it gives me something rather than takes away something.
Have you discussed your feelings about these various landscapes with your family?
Not recently. I think in the past, I remember it was difficult to discuss it with my parents. Because when they got to Tasmania, they were so happy. And they felt completely... they never once regretted moving there. They never... and they would say often, particularly in the last years of their lives, you know, the last 10 or 15 years of their lives, that, you know, that you know, they were so happy they'd chosen that place. They, you know, they really embraced it. They appreciated all the things that I'd complain about. They would just shrug off. But also, they were 40 years older than me when we arrived, so they were at a very different place in their life. They were looking for very, very different things. And as I, you know, my mother had had the most exciting, to my mind, childhood and early, you know, her formative years were in one of the most exciting places in the world at the time, and there's books to back it up, you know. So she'd lived a very rich life, and when she was, you know, ready to, when they moved to Tasmania, she was ready for that change. And now that I'm that, you know, I'm that age that she was, or older than that, I understand that, because there are different things you want at different times of your life. And so for her and for my father, it was the perfect timing and the perfect place, and they were looking for somewhere. And they wanted somewhere. I think one of the other reasons why they went to Tasmania and they loved it was back then, and even now, not so much, but back then particularly, it had fresh air and clean water. You know, again, it's this island at the end of the earth. I mean, it's surrounded by the Roaring Forties, which is one of the wildest, fiercest stretches of water. You know, deep and cold and dangerous to, you know, to sail on. And so that, you know, created this, you know, Tasmania was known and still is up to a certain extent for being pristine, even though it's not anymore, of course, there's nowhere is. So I couldn't really talk to about it really with my parents, the way I felt about the place, because when I did, and believe me, I did, they would, you know, disagree with me, or they would not be happy about it, and they wouldn't support, you know, they probably... You know, they made me feel bad for expressing that opinion, so I didn't do it too much, and I'd try and stop myself once I started if I realized that, oh, that's right, this is not an audience that, you know, is going to be very supportive for that. My sister, I know over, you know, there are times, because for many years I lived in the U.S. and I would go back and forth between the U.S. and Australia, and at that time, up until 2014, my sister always lived in Australia. Now she lives in England, but back then she was always in Australia. And so she would be my first port of call when I returned, and I would often stay with her. And the times when I stayed and, you know, was working in Melbourne, I would see her a fair bit. And so she was very aware of my feelings about it. And she was encouraging about my life in the US and my desire to be as far away from Tasmania as I could a lot of the time. So yeah, I did speak to them about it, and it, you know, within very, you know, with some support and with some very some not support.
We're sort of coming up towards the end of our time together.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you would like to say about place?
Hmm. know, it's been a long time. I've been the last few days, the last week or 10 days since I've been in the US on this trip, I've been trying to recall a quote. There was a short film I wrote many years ago when I was writing it when I was first in New Mexico, and it was never made into a short film, but I've got the script and I haven't looked at it for a long time. But there was a quote that inspired me. You know, I can't for the life of me remember the author. I mean, I can see it, but I can't quite name it, the name of the book, or even the names of the characters. But it was about a cowboy who was reflecting on his life and saying things along the lines of, you know, I always went around from place to place looking for the perfect place to be, like the place where I'd be feel home. And he was saying this ruefully, and the bottom line, it was the language was great within that cowboy kind of talk. It might have been, McMurtry. I think it was Larry McMurtry, so one of his kind of novels. And this cowboy kind of ruefully says, you know, I spent all that time going from place to place, and what I didn't realize, I should have just stopped in one place and made it my home, because now it's too late. And that, you know, again, that was a quote that I pulled 20 odd years ago, and it's resonated, even though I haven't looked at it now for a long time. I think as soon as I get home, I'm going to pull that out because I really want to read it, because it was so poetic and it's so strong. And I think I knew when I pulled that when I was 25 or 26, I knew how profound that was. You know, because I think, you know, I have been searching for the place. And, you know, that led me from Tasmania to New Mexico to New York to Tasmania to New York to New Mexico to New York. You know, like all this stuff, and all that travel has been for reasons, and I don't regret it. But I really do understand even more the value of that quote, in the sense that, you know, you make place, you know, you make the place. You have to choose, you have to stop, and then make that your home and make that your place. You know, if you're not happy, it doesn't matter. You can make it your place.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing. I'm going to stop us there.
Yeah.
That's okay. Great.